From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes, self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of environmental issues, alternative healthcare, new psychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. Today, my guest, award-winning television documentary producer Chuck Whitner. He has produced a very, very exciting program called What Your Doctor Won't Tell You About Cancer. It's a documentary that can save your life. It's hosted by Eddie Albert. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
I guess the biggest issue here is that most of the major networks are not interested in the documentary that you've made about this now, are they?
Well, they're certainly not interested in running it. we have been everywhere with it, and I had an agent do it for me as well as do it myself. And just no one will run this, even if we come in with a sponsor, which is very unusual.
What is the actual problem here? Is it the fact that this is a very touchy subject with the AMA?
Well, I would think that that would be part of it. Of course, all you know is what they tell you, and they're not going to tell you if that's the case. You know, every show tells you something different. An entertainment kind of an NBC or an ABC would say, well, gee, it's an interesting show, but unless our news department did it, we're not interested in running it. Public television would say, well, gee, we have so many worthy subjects that we can't choose them all. And, of course, that's true, too. But they, with television, I think AIDS has been a major factor. It's so much of a media event. So many people are interested in it. It's a new story compared to cancer. And I think that the public has really gotten a huge amount of information about AIDS, and at the expense of having information about a subject that they're more likely to get than AIDS.
So are we saying that basically what we're looking at is the fact that cancer doesn't pay the bills for the TV and radio networks?
Well, does cancer do it? Gosh, I can answer that a lot of different ways. There are a lot of products that are out there that are either suspected or known carcinogens, and of course there are a lot of drug companies that, next to soft drinks, drug companies are the top advertisers on television, next to soft drinks and beer. Then it comes pharmaceuticals, and of course these companies, these same ones that make the over-the-counter remedies, are also making the drugs of chemotherapy, and they are, by in large part, dictating what our health policy and our cancer policy specifically are. And this is also true with PBS, that some friends of mine call now a petrochemical broadcast system, since so many petrochemical companies sponsor public, what used to be called public television. I guess it's still called that, at least temporarily. Most of it, in fact, is underwritten, which is just another word for sponsored, by these major companies, oil industry and the pharmaceutical industry. So you have to, I guess, put two and two together. And in that regard, I guess I have nobody to blame but myself, but I just, throughout the whole production of this, just felt because we didn't set out to make a controversial film. I mean, we set out to make a film that would have been marketed to doctors and to hospitals. We had questions. My mother-in-law was in the hospital with a cancer diagnosis. We didn't know anything about the disease. It was just a word. No one in our family had ever had it before. And when we started asking questions to the doctors, what is the disease? How does it work? How might she have gotten it? Might her kids get it? Is my wife vulnerable? What is this all about? And more specifically, or more immediately, what's going to happen to our mother-in-law, my mother-in-law? What's going to happen to her? Is she going to get better? What's the therapy supposed to do? I mean, questions that I think every normal family would have upon admitting a person to the hospital. But we were told there's no time to answer this, and besides, you're not doctors anyway. They may sound like simple questions, but they're complex answers, and you couldn't understand it. You don't have a medical degree, which was not exactly an acceptable answer. And so we went out to do research to make, much later, to make a film that would answer those questions so that when doctors didn't have time, they could say, here, pop in the video, and the hospital would have the video. I have distributed other films of mine to institutions before, and I've had experience doing that. So that's what we intended to do. But it wasn't until we were deep into the research that we realized that the things that these doctors and hospitals were telling us was not the key information for people to have. That there were things out there that people ought to know about that would be offensive to both those institutions and the major industries that support them.
He is an award-winning television documentary producer who has produced films, Victims is one, and Angel Dust. Very quickly, Victims is a film about what?
It's a film about child abuse. It was one of the first documentaries on child abuse, so long before the sort of media explosion in child abuse in the early 80s with McMartin. This was produced in 1978. It was a look, I didn't think it was going to be a controversial film, but it ended up being one. It was a film that advocated that we not hit children. I was very surprised to find how many parents in this country do hit their children. I never was hit, and this was, so it took time to catch on, but it did catch on, and it did very well. Christina Crawford, the author of Mommy Dearest, was our host, and it was a very successful film. It was played on the ABC network, and then we also distributed this independently to child abuse agencies and police departments and prisons, and it was used both for therapy as well as for broadcast. And then before that, the other well-known TV film was called Angel Dust, a documentary on chronic drug addiction that took a different approach. It was not a scare film. It took a different approach and just watched a chronic drug abuser who felt there was no problem in his life, but we just sort of watch him rather deteriorate on film. And that's, anyhow, that ran, I think, in 77 and then again in 79. So those were the two best-known independent films that we distributed to institutions. And we did a lot of other television things strictly for networks in the meantime. And then this was our first independent film in about 10 years.
All right, Chuck, the name of the movie that you're having the problems with now is called What Your Doctor Won't Tell You About Cancer. In 1971, the director of the National Cancer Institute told President Richard Nixon that if they had gotten $50 billion, they would cure cancer before the nation's bicentennial in 1976. What happened?
He said, all right. Well, what happened was that President Nixon signed into law what became known as the War on Cancer, appropriating increasing amounts of money. I believe the first year it was $10 billion, and with a goal of doing exactly what you just said, of eliminating cancer by 1976, which is what he was told would be done, and he made it a top priority of his administration and put more money into it than had ever been put into it before. In fact, the NCI had asked for $50 billion, and the president, I'm not a great Nixon fan, but he certainly had his heart in the right place here, he appropriated $80 billion. He did, any time somebody thought something was going to cost more, he said, okay, that was the kind of priority it was. Well, the result was we have since that time had an increase. Every year there has been an increase in the number of cancers in this country, and every year there has been an increase in the number of deaths. And this is even taking population, normal rising in population into consideration. We're getting cancer more often, we're dying from it more often, and we're dying from it at a younger age. Since that time, in 1971, we have put in over a trillion dollars into this war on cancer, and the only people that have benefited, by and large, there have been some successes, but by far the biggest successes have been the brokers in Wall Street that have made killings on drug company stocks for drugs that had great promise and had great PR campaigns on our media, but ultimately failed to cure the patients. Nevertheless, there were billions made on these drug company stocks and continue to be made at new stocks with new PR campaigns behind them, which are unloaded by the people in the know once they realize that the public will find out that the drug has failed. This has been going on for so many years, and I think it's just an inevitable outgrowth of a for-profit medical system.
So the point here, if I'm getting this right, is that we've got the same scenario going on now under the guise of AIDS now.
Yeah. yeah, this is coming out more and more. AIDS is not my topic of research, so I wouldn't claim to know this, but I know that another filmmaker, a person that I know of some integrity, is researching a film now on this subject, and also is finding that there are many therapies that, I mean, some of the doctors are actually using the word curing AIDS, which, of course, nobody in mainstream medicine is talking about here. I don't know that that's true, but I know that there are people who have been around with HIV for many, many years, have rejected AZT, have rejected DDI, and are using only a non-toxic, holistic, basically nutritional, metabolic approach to treating themselves, and they have not had the HIV go into an active AIDS. So I think that these kinds of therapies that we talk about in our film, supposedly alternative or complementary, as they're called in Europe, complementary therapies, because they certainly can be employed with other therapies. I think that the success of these, but certainly with cancer and maybe also with AIDS, is something that is just not being recognized by our medical establishment because there's just no money to be made on them.
Let's talk about cancer. Here's the situation. We have the United States of America, probably the largest country in the world, or it used to be anyway, overwhelming failure in cancer therapy, and yet the Food and Drug Administration continues to outlaw alternative cancer therapies, forcing Americans to go to other countries for it. What is your comment on that?
Well, it's so outrageous because the greater the failures, the tougher the FDA seems to get on people who are looking for new answers. It just makes no sense. Just a few weeks ago, up in Tacoma, Washington, a very well-known doctor, not an oncologist, but a doctor named Jonathan Wright, was absolutely stormed by the Food and Drug Administration, who came in like it was a drug bust with their flak jackets on and guns drawn and putting handcuffs on nurses and, you know, pushing them up against the wall. Why? What was his great crime? He was using a form of vitamin therapy, importing vitamins from Germany instead of from our drug companies here, because he believed that they were a more pure form of the vitamin, and that was it. There were no charges actually filed. There were no arrests made. The FDA just was able to go in Gestapo style and take all this man's product and his records and basically destroy him without any due process. That's what's happening in this country now. That's just one example. There are at least five others that I can give that have happened in just this calendar year. And it just is amazing to me that as our system, I think, is getting more and more failures in medicine, we read about the rising costs of health care, and yet you look at the results of that health care, and it's disastrous. We are absolutely getting no better, and we're not living any longer. We're certainly not any healthier than we were 50 years ago. And, you know, you think that with rising costs would come better product. Well, it doesn't seem to be working out that way. The reason there are these rising costs is because of the monopoly that has been created by the American Medical Association and its, being created by the major drug companies and its marketing division, the American Medical Association. And, you know, they are simply outlawing any form of holistic nutritional therapy. And as a result, their prices go up because you and I have no choice. There's a bill pending right now in the state of California. It was put up by a man that I have supported most of my life, Henry Waxman. He's a U.S. congressman down here and the chairman of the powerful Health and Environmental Committee. And this would outlaw your right and my right to go into a store and buy vitamin supplements. You believe that? Now, this is not getting any press. But that law is pending before Congress right now, and we're not finding out about it. And that you would have to have a doctor's prescription to buy this stuff, buy vitamin supplements. It would also give even greater powers to the Food and Drug Administration. And I don't understand why Mr. Waxman is doing this. He's playing naive. And although a member of a political action committee of New York just told me that he did an investigation, I haven't seen these figures, but I trust this person. And found out that nearly $400,000 of Mr. Waxman's campaign coffers were paid for by pharmaceutical companies. Now, I don't know that that's true because I haven't seen it. I've asked him to send me a copy of it, but it comes from what I would consider a fairly reliable source.
All right. Now, the tobacco, alcohol, and prescription drug industries are among the most powerful lobbies. That's what you say. You say that the tobacco industry and the American Medical Association conspired for years to withhold information about tobacco and cancer. Why don't you comment on this and tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, this isn't just hearsay. Our film shows that the actual documents and letters and, you know, marked confidential and so forth between the American Medical Association and the tobacco industry. This came out in a trial, which I think is still actually pending in the Supreme Court now, the Cipollone case in New Jersey. It was a product liability trial with an individual trying to sue a tobacco company for the death of this person's spouse. But during that trial, these documents were submitted that clearly show letters from the president of the American Medical Association to the Food and Drug Administration, urging them not to require warning labels on cigarettes, saying that after all, this should be an act of Congress, and we shouldn't, you know, be involved here. And then we have other documents that show that there were huge payments made by the AMA to the various companies of the industry, five of them to be exact. And you know, this kind of collaboration was going on well after the dangers of smoking were known, especially in relationship to cancer. There were payments made by the tobacco industry to Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in order to silence one of the prime researchers in this instance of tobacco and lung cancer, a man named Dr. Ernst Winder, who was a highly credited scientist with Sloan Kettering and had published many, many studies about cancer before. And he did a now very famous study of painting tobacco residue on mice's skin and seeing them develop skin tumors, which was a very direct and easily seen cause and effect. There were at least five payments that we saw, $25,000 each, paid by the tobacco companies to Sloan Kettering if they would replace Mr. Winder and not allow him to speak to the press anymore on their behalf. Well, guess what? That's exactly what they did. And there's a magazine called Roll Call that is given to every congressman and everybody who works on Capitol Hill, Congress, Senate, executive, and judicial branches. That's their audience. And just in the June 20th, last year, like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, in their edition, there were still articles by senators saying, get the Food and Drug Administration out of the tobacco industry. That's not what they were set up for. They should let free market forces prevail and so forth. So there is still all this here. But then, of course, you and I are still actually subsidizing the tobacco industry. Some of our tax dollars are actually being sent to tobacco companies for certain, you know, harvesting practices. It's unbelievable that we're doing it, but we are.
You say in the movie, and for those of you who are listening, I had a chance to look at this. What an excellent documentary. That the American Medical Association has sitting on their board some of their main contributors, including many of the tobacco industry. Is that correct?
Actually, it's Sloan Kettering Hospital that we show in there. I don't know if there is a real board of the AMA. The board of the AMA would be all doctors. But on the board of Sloan Kettering, yes, the director of the Philip Morris Company, at least as of a few months ago. I keep checking to make sure he's still there. He is. And so are directors of big drug companies and big oil companies. And I wonder how many of your listeners know. I mean, I suppose most of you have heard of Sloan Kettering. I had heard of Sloan Kettering even before we did the research. But what I didn't realize is that Sloan and Kettering weren't doctors. They were General Motors executives. And Sloan Kettering was actually set up as a nonprofit foundation that involved the oil industry and the car industry and many other industries of that kind that were getting together, the chemical industry, and that were trying to use the products that they already had to possibly kill cancer. It sounded very noble, but of course there are these problems when you realize that their primary products are the ones that cause cancer. Now, do you expect them to really institute policies of prevention if it means basically, you know, outlawing or at least hurting their other subsidiaries, the major ones that are bringing in the money for those corporations? Not likely. And that's the problem that we have. And I think it's inevitable in any for-profit system. And I say that because if you go to Europe and you look at the various forms, not just Europe, but Japan, India, many other countries of the world, Africa even, where they have other forms of therapy, which certainly do include chemotherapy and radiation and surgery, the way we do here, but they also are allowed to have non-toxic holistic therapies. Well, this doesn't prove cause and effect, but those countries have far lower incidences of cancer than we do, and they also have higher cure rates than we do. I think there's something that we can take from that. If nothing else, then a willingness to admit that we don't have the answers now, and that we need to open it up to indeed market forces, if that's what it takes. If alternative cancer therapy really is quackery, then I think that will be found out in the marketplace. Let it prevail, and I think we'll realize that it is not quackery in most cases, that it's very helpful. People are living longer with it than if they do just mainstream therapy alone, and many would say if they do it at all, that in fact, in many cases, these alternative therapies should indeed be alternatives and not used with other therapies. There are others, of course, that use them in conjunction with, which is why that phrase complementary therapy is the one that is operative in Europe.
All right, now let's see. So I made a grave error here. I said American Medical Association. I think I was remembering now. Was it the National Cancer Institute or the American Cancer Society?
Oh, well, the ones we show in the hospital, again, were Sloan Kettering, but you're dealing with sort of a lateral moving triad here. The NCI, National Cancer Institute, which is a division of our federal government under the Department of Health, the American Cancer Society, which is a private charity, the largest charity in the world, and Sloan Kettering, which is the premier hospital of cancer research in this country and has been for many years. All of these organizations, the heads of all of them, the major contributors, are the industrialists, are the major automotive, oil, petrochemical industries. That's what keeps it all going. For example, in our film is Dr. Vincent DeVita, who for 9 years was the director of the National Cancer Institute. When he left that position, he became the physician-in-chief at Memorial Sloan Kettering. Might he get involved in an executive position at the American Cancer Society? I wouldn't be surprised. You find these executives, float around just the way you'll see with the movie executives, floating around different companies and going back and forth from TV and movie studios. I mean, it's a lateral move.
All right. Perhaps the motion picture should be called What Your Doctor Can't Tell You About Cancer instead of Won't. But that is the title. What Your Doctor Won't Tell You About Cancer. It is a documentary produced by my guest today, Chuck Wintner. So the point here, I guess, is this. Here we have a number of solutions that have been presented, and we're going to use this, I think, a very, very good example. The National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society say we should eat low-fat, high-fiber diet with mostly fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. Yet, in order to maximize profits, hospitals serve cancer patients the exact opposite of this diet. High-fat, high-sugar, low-fiber foods that are cheap to make. What is your feeling about this?
When this really came home to us, this was one of our transitional discoveries that took us away from making what we thought would be a mainstream film. We started out, we did sequences with the National Cancer Institute, all the people you just mentioned. Okay, we shot sequences in their hospitals, in-depth interviews with a chemotherapist, a radiation oncologist, a radiologist, an oncologist, and the executives and the directors of all of these different organizations. That's what we thought was going to be the meat of our film. And then we realized we needed another element, the patients. So we went to this one hospital where the American Cancer Society president happened to be working, and we said, well, can we go around and shoot interviews with some of your patients, and we'd like to follow them, get back together, watch them going through therapy, not necessarily getting injections, but maybe, but to see what they did when they went home, how they adjusted to this. We want to help other cancer patients out there and maybe find something inspiring. Well, we started, though, with those interviews in the hospital, and it was during the interviews they just happened to bring in lunch. And we looked at it and went, my God, it was just awful. I mean, it was just the exact, it was like a joke. Because we did ask some of these people questions about diet and had they thought about changing it now that they had cancer and with the new stuff, I say new, new. It's not new anymore. This was in 85. They thought about the news, you know, information was coming out about diet and cancer. Were they going to make any changes in their life? And here was the hospital serving just this, you know, gooey, fat-laden, you know, awful stuff, just the antithesis of what their recommendations were from these big cancer groups. And patients sitting there eating, you know, with one hand and smoking cigarettes with the other hand, which two of them did. And there was no even offer or suggestion but made by these doctors. And the doctors admitted this, as well as the patients, that they stopped smoking while they're getting cancer therapy. I mean, that just seemed really wrong to us. And we thought we had an exceptional hospital, even though it was a very well-known and highly touted hospital in Southern California. We figured, you know, we just had a quirk here. But then we did research and found out, no, there was no such quirk, that hospital meals are designed not with any nutritional needs in mind. Of course, hospital dietitians would argue with that. But they certainly do not conform to the guidelines laid down by the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute for the proper anti-cancer diet. And then when we questioned that, you know what they said to us? They said, well, those guidelines are for prevention. These people already have cancer. So we haven't done studies on cancer patients to know whether or not this diet would also be good for them. Now, I'm sorry, I'm not a scientist, but I think that's ridiculous. I just think that is absurd. If it's good for, I mean, they're supposedly going to leave the hospital without any cancer. They're going to cut it away or zap it away or burn it away or poison it away. That's the So isn't then a recurrence prevention? Isn't staying away from a recurrence prevention? And, I mean, to say that we have no studies on that. But one doctor really shocked us with his candor. This was the man who was a former president of the American Cancer Society. When we said, why don't hospitals give more information to patients about cancer prevention, especially about diet? You know what his answer was? The insurance companies don't pay us to do that. Why should we? Now, here are people making millions of dollars. Oncologists make fortunes, much more than the average physician. To take 5 or 10 minutes to sit down and give these patients new guidelines, if they smoke, say, look, here's how to get off of cigarettes, I think you should do it. Now, would that matter, incidentally? Well, there was a study done in England by The Lancet, which is their top medical journal, that showed when doctors in England told their patients not to smoke, even though those patients had heard hundreds and hundreds of anti-smoking messages from other people before, when their doctors told them to stop smoking, 20% of them quit right on the spot and never had another cigarette after that. Now, that's realizing the enormous power of addiction. That, to me, is a very impressive figure. That would translate to hundreds of thousands of smoking quitters in America in a given year. And yet doctors generally don't do that. Why? Insurance companies don't pay them to do that. I just thought that was one of the most obnoxious things that I had ever heard out of a doctor's mouth. And yet he was telling us the truth. He was speaking not just for himself, but for the medical community. His point was, oh, we should get more money even than we're getting now from the insurance companies and, you know, God knows what else, if we're going to tell patients not to smoke or how they might quit smoking or how they might improve their diet or whether or not supplementation might be beneficial to them. We're not going to tell them all this stuff unless we get more money to do so. I mean, it was just screaming at us as one of the most horrible abuses of the profit system that I could see. I mean, when it comes to medicine, I think the for-profit system is at its ugliest, and I think we need to have overall reform.
Let's talk a minute about President Reagan. We know that toxic emissions cause cancer, but it takes about 20 years to trace these. And yet, in 1980, President Reagan relaxed environmental laws to where corporations have had very few restrictions now placed on these same emissions. Again, it's no wonder that by the year 2000, we expect to have cancer overtake heart disease. And, of course, that's what you talk about in the film.
Yes. Well, it's things really changed when Reagan became president. Under President Carter, we had what was called a zero-tolerance policy, that if any substance was known to cause any cancer, that you simply took it out of the environment. And more importantly, it was the onus of the company producing this to, number one, show studies of whether or not it did cause cancer. They had to spend the money and do the research, even to try to show that their product might cause cancer. But then they, of course, had the right to also show how they would destroy those emissions before any damage was done. Okay, that was what the policy was. Well, after Reagan, there was a major change. The companies no longer had to prove that they didn't cause cancer. You and I have got to go out there and prove that they do. Well, that's absolutely impossible. I mean, you can't even prove any one particular cancer is caused by anything. Even the tobacco companies so far have not had to pay a claim in any product liability case. Though probably there's no disagreement now among experts of any persuasion that tobacco causes cancer. And yet, you might find a person with lung cancer who has been smoking for God knows how many years, 50 years, you could not prove that his cancer was therefore caused by that tobacco. There are just too many other contacts that we all make with carcinogens. And that, of course, is the point. It's the number and the degree of carcinogenicity that our whole country has become. When a scientist, let's say, which is to say an employee of one of these companies, or an associate of one of these companies, comes along and says, well, we can't prove that this pesticide or ALAR, let's say, to use a real well-known one, has caused cancer in any person. You would have to consume 800 pounds of ALAR a day for 900 years in order for it to kill you, or something to that effect. What all of those statements fail to take into consideration is something called synergy, which is how one builds upon another. When cancer happens, there is a two-stage event that occurs. The first is called initiation, and the second is called promotion. In initiation, a cancer cell is damaged. Now, that's a key point because, you know, cells die every day, and that we all have cells that die every day, and that's no problem because our body can manufacture new cells to take their place. But when a cell is damaged, possibly the body can repair the damage on its own using its own immune system. But sometimes, especially if that cell is just nearing the stage of mitosis, it is just starting to begin to divide, maybe that cell will not be repaired by the body's natural abilities. But what will happen is if that cell comes in now into contact with a carcinogen, the second step called promotion would occur so that it duplicates, it divides, if you remember seventh grade biology, you know, the little chromosomes all run to the center of the nucleus and then they pull apart and then they come together and then two cells are formed. But now both of those cells may have a damaged chromosome, a damaged gene that could come in contact with a carcinogen without being repaired. And especially if that gene is what scientists now believe is called an oncogene or a certain gene that is lends itself toward becoming cancer. This is how cancer occurs. The more exposures we have to substances that cause cancer, the more likely we are to have one or both of these stages occur. And when they say, oh, our product isn't causing cancer because, look, we've isolated it in a test tube and we've, you know, only, you know, a few of the rats died, and we gave them such a huge amount that, you know, no human would ever ingest them. The first thing we have to say to ourselves is, yeah, but there are all of these other substances that now we're going to add this new one into the soup, and this carcinogenic soup that we all live in, and it's going to increase our likelihood for cancer. So this policy now of you and I having to go out and prove something does cause cancer, it has just completely changed our environment. There were estimates even from other branches of the federal government that in 1988 that the number of carcinogens we were now exposed to had doubled during the Reagan administration. I have seen no new figures since the Bush administration, but there certainly has been no new policy, and the amount of exposure that you and I face is rising exponentially every day. And we've got to do something about it. If we can't stop these policies from happening, or at least we can't retard them somewhat, we've got to do whatever it takes to protect ourselves from their devastating effects.
All right. Now, the first script of your film was written in 1987. And in that first script, you said that a woman's chances of contracting breast cancer were 1 in 13. And yet by the time you finished the film in 1991, the figure had grown to 1 in 9. Why?
Yeah, boy, no one knows. Absolutely no one knows. There are a few theories. Of course, there are official theories and there are other theories. Doctors will, no respecting oncologists would even hazard an answer to that guess. I mean, a guess to that question. I, in fact, ended up taking the entire breast cancer section that we had written out of the film. It's still the one area that I feel least qualified to answer any questions on. I mean, we did probably more research on breast cancer than any other specific form of breast cancer. But it's just, it's very hard to tell. But I'll tell you one thing that is for sure. We have a breast cancer epidemic in this country, and it is not being discussed. What we're getting is a media blitz on mammograms. Oh, have a mammogram, have a mammogram, have a mammogram. All you'd have to do is get a mammogram every year, and then even if you do get breast cancer, we'll get it in its early stages. And our treatment now in early stages is so wonderful that we'll give that to you, and you needn't ever worry about dying from breast cancer. As long as you have those mammograms every year and then do what we tell you when it gets formed, getting therapy. I mean, that's the basic message we've been hearing on the media for the last several years. I mean, you can't open a woman's magazine anywhere, so-called woman's magazine, without some article about why women should get mammograms. Well, there is absolutely no justification to say that all you need is mammograms and early stage detection, and that's going to prevent you from dying from breast cancer. In fact, there are studies now that are showing the opposite, that that people who have breast cancer are more likely than the general public to have already had mammograms, that the people who are getting cancer are ones who have been getting mammograms since early on. Does that mean the mammograms are causing the cancer? I wouldn't say it. I don't know it, but I wouldn't say it. The establishment, of course, vociferously denies that, but they also vociferously denied that x-rays were doing us any harm in the 50s and early 60s, too, until studies showed otherwise. As far as being able to detect early cancer, however, yeah, that's the other side. That there have been women who have learned of early calcifications, which were likely to turn into cancer, or had already turned into a small cancer as a result of a routine mammogram. And those women did have early stage treatment, and they're better, and they're fine. You know, but I can't see, frankly, any connections between the ones that get better and the ones that don't get better. I mean, there's nothing. It's a real tough one. It's a very, very problematic one. But I think that when it comes to cause, most of the new cancers are what are called estrogen-based cancers. And that means that they affect the receptor sites of the estrogen hormone, or the female hormone. Women have that hormone in their system longer today than ever before for two reasons. If you ask the male physicians, they would say, well, one factor is that women are delaying pregnancy, or they're deciding not to have children at all. And as long as they're deciding that, they're going to have estrogen running through their body until they reach menopause, which is true. When a woman becomes pregnant, that flow of estrogen stops. Now, you got to remember, estrogen is a very powerful carcinogen. Yes, of course, it's needed in the female body. It's needed to bring all of us into life. Estrogen must be there, but in high doses, which sometimes do seem to concentrate in some women around certain receptor sites, it can become carcinogenic. And yet, as I say, it's necessary for our existence. So a feminist would say, wait a minute, are you saying that we're causing our own breast cancers because we're not having children earlier? Well, that might be a factor, but there is another factor, too, that, of course, the doctors and the drug companies aren't talking about, and that is that in our chickens and cattle and dairy products today are exactly those same kinds of estrogen-based compounds. We give these livestock estrogen to prevent many diseases that they might otherwise get, to fatten, we're giving them other hormones to fatten them up more quickly and get them to market and therefore increase the profit, even though we know that these substances cause cancer. So that children today, are young girls, during World War II, at the end of World War II, the average girl in this country began her first menstruation at age 15. today it is age 11 and dropping. It certainly seems to me that the ingestion of this hormone has got to be a factor, especially when you realize in countries that have banned the use of these chemicals, Japan and most countries of Europe, they have a lower breast cancer rate, they have a later onset of menstruation, and they have girls reaching maturity at a much later time. That also, of course, retards the use and shortens the time period that the estrogen will be running through the body. So I think that there's something wrong about having known carcinogens in the diet, especially the diets of children, that is likely to pay off in 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years later. No one knows when a cancer is going to hit. It can start very, very early and not manifest itself until that cell has divided thousands of times. But that's the risk that we take, and that's why I think we should go back to the Carter administration policy of a zero tolerance for known carcinogenic products.
The dangers of asbestos have been known since the turn of this century, and despite efforts by environmental groups to ban its use, asbestos is still used for all U.S.-made brake linings and clutch pads, and yet virtually no European cars use asbestos at all.
Yeah, I know. Well, of course, there are big asbestos mines in this country, and the asbestos has been a very powerful lobbying group. We've known about the dangers of asbestos much longer even than we've known about tobacco, and we have evidence of tobacco from the 30s. But the evidence against asbestos goes all the way back to at least the early 1900s and maybe even before. It was especially found out about naval shipyard workers that worked around asbestos. They can get a condition called asbestosis, which is technically not cancer, but it's devastating. The most common cancer is called mesothelioma. It's the one that killed Steve McQueen. And it's virtually a deadly form of cancer of the chest wall, the lining of the chest wall. It's thought of, some people look at it as lung cancer. It's not really lung cancer. Although, again, to go back earlier, what I was saying about synergy before, it's been shown that asbestos workers who smoke are 20 times more likely to get mesothelioma than asbestos workers who don't smoke. And that just shows the synergistic effect of carcinogens, so the more they're exposed. A couple of years ago when my wife and I had children and we were learning about this, we decided we had to buy a new car. And we ended up buying a Volvo, and I thought, oh no, everyone's going to say I've become a yuppie, you know, for buying a Volvo. But, you know, I could see why. You start thinking about safety and health, especially when you have children. In our case, it started just a short time before that when we were producing this film and we learned about it. And, you know, Mercedes and BMW and Volvo and none of those cars use asbestos. Virtually all clutch pads and brake linings in this country are made from asbestos. See, but asbestos is indestructible. And that's its blessing and its curse. In fact, I shot a film years ago, many years ago. I guess I don't remember who the client was. I think it was the fire department that we went out with, and it was in the middle of the desert. And they were showing a test of this asbestos suit, and they dug a hole in the ground and they lit a fire. And this man actually walked into this fire pit with his suit, stayed there a full minute, and walked out again. And that shows you how indestructible asbestos is and why it is so, when it was discovered, it was just thought, this is just incredible. What a wonderful thing to have. Well, unfortunately, when asbestos dust gets into your lungs, guess what? It's indestructible, too. Your lymphocytes will not take care of it. Your body's immune system, the macrophages, will not neutralize them. They will stay there, and they'll stay there forever. And so they can lead to cancer and asbestosis. And if nothing else, they can simply diminish it. The whole time you've got something, some foreign product, some foreign something in your body, you've got the cells of your immune system that are fighting to get rid of it. And if they're spinning their wheels, so to speak, and then some other disease comes into contact with you, well, you're going to therefore have fewer lymphocytes and fewer cells working for you. That's what we mean by lowering the immune system. That's how the ingestion of toxic substances, even if you can't prove that by themselves they cause cancer, that's how they do. You weaken your immune system enough, and then contact with any toxic or any carcinogenic substance is much more likely to do its damage.
So a person just walking on the street, jogging, taking care of themselves, is going to get a tremendous amount of asbestos just by breathing in the air from the cars passing by.
I think the runner, I jog myself and I do it on a track, and I think runners who run by the street are absolutely nuts. I can't believe they think they're doing themselves good. This is extremely deadly. There was a study done by our federal government among city dwellers. Now, people just live in the urban heavy traffic environments. They did an autopsy study of people who had died that they had to conduct autopsies for, and they decided they're going to autopsy their lungs too. 90% of them had asbestos in their lungs. 90%. Well, now, they died of other causes, most likely, in most of their cases. So no one would say, well, therefore, you know, the asbestos killed them. But the asbestos was doing its damage. It was weakening them somehow. And 90% of the city dwellers had that. And I think, you know, in high smog days, you just can't work out the way you do in other days. And running by the freeway, boy, I wish I'd have put it. I didn't put a scene from that in my film. I wish I would have now, especially now that you mention it. I think people should definitely know they are not being healthy when they run in heavy traffic or on high smog days.
All right, now the motion picture or documentary is called What Your Doctor Won't Tell You About Cancer. Chuck Whitner is my guest today. He is the award-winning television documentary producer, and the show is hosted by Eddie Albert. Chuck, we're getting close here to running out of time. You've got 8 points. Let's talk about the 8 points. These are things that doctors won't tell you about cancer. When you receive a cancer diagnosis, what should you do?
Okay, first of all, do not panic. It is not a death sentence. Okay, realize that the cells have been growing in you for a long time, and yes, it's time to take action now, but you needn't be forced into a panic situation, which doctors will often try to put you in. A doctor is liable to say to you, you have cancer. There's no doubt about it. I think you should start chemotherapy the first thing tomorrow morning. No, you shouldn't. You should take time and get a second or third opinion, and including an opinion from somebody with a different discipline than your doctor. In other words, some alternative therapy. It doesn't mean that you're looking to put your doctor down. It doesn't mean you won't also do what he says. But it's the time to start nurturing your own immune system and to look into alternatives. Find out either from your doctor or you can do research in the library as to what the likelihood of your particular cancer is for cure, what the success rate is of various therapies. Ask your doctor those questions. If your doctor is not willing to answer them, get a new doctor and start all over again. Just don't panic. Research your own illness. Keep your mind open toward alternatives, either, again, as an alternative or as a complementary therapy. And realize this, too. I've met many, many, many cancer patients over the last few years. And for many of them, while it certainly is a horrible tragedy to learn you have cancer, for many of them, they say to me, you know, I didn't begin to live until I had this diagnosis. That it becomes a time of great personal growth, of really living every day for its beauty and its excellence and for the gift that it is. And it does make you appreciate life more. Again, I'm not saying it's a good thing to have, but realize that this can be a very important and very inspirational time of your life. So it's nothing to run away from or to think about euthanasia or automatically concluding you're going to die. But there are these precautions that you do need to take, and then make your choice. Listen to as many points of view as you can and make your choice. Yes, you can understand how your body works. Yes, you can understand your disease. Don't let them think you're not qualified to have an opinion here. It's your body. And if you listen to enough people, I think we all do have what Dr. Albert Schweitzer said, a doctor within us that really knows why we're sick and knows what it would take to get better. And if we talk to enough doctors, I think some of what they say will have a ring of truth, and that's the one to go with, and that's the one to do their therapy by. Maybe, again, not to the exclusion of others, but I think listen to your body, listen to what the message is of that cancer, and find a doctor that speaks to it.
All right, now, boy, are we running out of time here, Chuck. Chuck, is there a rental program that you might have for organizations that were interested in seeing your film?
There are certainly things that could be set up. I mean, the only way we're getting the message out there, since television won't run it, is that we're showing this at various health festivals, whole life expos, and there are new organizations springing up among doctors that are looking for alternatives. We're especially interested in showing it there. There are ways that people can find out more about the film and about purchasing it. We don't really have a rental program yet. We haven't gotten a national distributor to take care of this.
Chuck, we have a few minutes. I know that your mother-in-law did die. She died within a few weeks after the treatment began. What are your feelings about what might have been done if you had known then what you know now?
Boy, even with all this, you know, I think I know why she got the cancer now. But frankly, I don't think that the kind of cancer she had could have been cured by anybody. She had acute lymphocytic leukemia. She was an artist, and she often worked with spray paints, and she often worked in poorly ventilated areas. And those paints, many of them give off a very strong odor of benzene. And benzene is known to cause leukemia, and that's what she had, acute lymphocytic leukemia. And the acute nature of it especially points to benzene. People should always, by the way, you know, who work in that. And, of course, just ordinary gasoline in this country gives off benzene. And when you pump your own gas, you should not allow yourself to smell that gas. Turn your head away. As far as my own mother-in-law, had we to do it all over again, she knew more about this stuff than any of us did. You know, we pushed her for it. She just wanted to let herself go. You know, she didn't want to have any therapy. We talked her into chemotherapy because we were so convinced that what the doctors were telling us was true, that she'd go into remission. She'd at least have a few good years, and they did it stress, good years, and that there was every likelihood a new drug would be discovered during that time that could prolong her life even longer. We bought it, hook, line, and sinker. She was more skeptical, but did it because we asked her to. Oh, you've asked me a very tough question.
Well, listen, I'll tell you what, Chuck. I know that our listeners appreciate this. I think the important point here was that you've been very candid about this. I realize that was a tough question. But on the other side of it, those people who are listening, cancer is touching almost all of us now. As you say in your documentary, 3 out of 4 families are stricken by cancer. The point here is that this is a very difficult subject to talk about. I certainly appreciate the fact that you've done such a great service to the community by making this film. Again, the film is called What Your Doctor Won't Tell You About Cancer. Chuck, we have to go. I want to thank you for being on the air.
Thank you very much, Bruce. I appreciate it very much.
And for those of you who are listening to Timeless Voyager Radio, this is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and I just want to say to all of you, I appreciate the fact that you take the time to listen to Timeless Voyager Radio. I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.